Wondering how to navigate local, city, state, or the federal government in order to grow your business, secure funding for your nonprofit, or advance your organization's agenda? Welcome to Lobbying Insider, a podcast that brings listeners to the intersection of business and government to provide a rare perspective on how things actually get done. We will dive into some pressing current issues, provide keen observations from the past, and keep an ever-watchful eye on what's coming next. I'm your host, Zach Fink, Director of External Affairs at Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron. Glad to have you with us. And we are joined today by a special guest, the Brooklyn District Attorney, Eric Gonzalez. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it. Let me start just by asking you a little bit about what's going on in Brooklyn. My understanding is you've had some success bringing down crime rates there. I know that it's very much a topic on people's minds lately, these last several years, post-pandemic. People at least have a perception that crime has gone up. But what have you been doing to kind of enforce that and make sure that the people are no longer feeling unsafe in their communities?
Well, the good news is that Brooklyn has seen year after year reductions in violence in particular. And in 2024, last year, it actually was the safest year in the history of Brooklyn, at least since they've recorded the stats. And so that's an incredible accomplishment to go from where we were in 2020 and, in several years, reduce it to the lowest it's ever been. And so let's be clear, it's lower than it's ever been pre-pandemic. The violence is coming down, the fewest number of people ever shot in the county. A lot of progress being made on the most violent cases, dealing with gang violence, dealing with shootings. This year, we're down in the first quarter over 40% in homicides. So real substantive good news for the people of Brooklyn. When I took the office, I said to the people of Brooklyn that I would make gun violence my number one priority. And I am happy that we're delivering on those promises.
And how do you do something like that? I mean, do you identify problem areas? I mean, how do you focus on where the problems are?
Yeah, I think, I changed the way we were doing it in Brooklyn. We focus in primarily on the drivers of violence, which means that we have a focus on individuals that the community and the police department tells us. These are the people who are committing violence in our community, so we're paying attention to them. And whenever they come before my office, whether it's a big case, a serious case, or a low-level case, we're putting senior prosecutors on those cases to make sure that they're held accountable on those cases. But what I've really done differently is the traditional prosecution that you might have seen on Law and Order really focused in on, witnesses and people coming to court and being at the mercy of, the court system dependent on testimonial evidence. I've spent a lot of time building out a very sophisticated technology in my office. So we have a state-of-the-art digital evidence lab. We have a crime strategies unit. And what we're doing is we're looking at these cases from a digital technical perspective. Can we prove the case using technology? And so we're very invested in proving our cases outside of the use of just witnesses. And, the police will tell you in gang cases in particular, very hard to secure cooperation and participation of community members. They're afraid. So we're building these cases using technology, using social media, using surveillance, using DNA, but also a lot coming out of cell phones. What we're able to do with someone's cell phone is incredible. If we get our hands on that cell phone, we can use apps and see exactly where they were at times with location services. So we're really using technology in really wonderful ways to help promote the cases before the jury so they can see it. And it's also important because that technology also allows us to prevent wrongful convictions based on erroneous identifications and things that have troubled the system before.
And I would imagine technology has made law enforcement, I mean, people might not even realize this, but made it so that, it tracks your locations, it can tell you where they were at any given moment. I mean, I would imagine that's a huge enhancement.
Yeah, I mean, the information that's stored in the cloud. So our digital evidence lab is able really to, with the use of subpoenas and court-ordered permissions, we're really allowed to get a lot of information. It will allow us to solve cases that in the past never got solved. And it's been a real win for the county. And we've invested millions of dollars into technology, training our ADAs and how to do this. And so kind of just changing the way we pursued cases. Before, the cases were really sort of, you know, the detective on the ground, shoe leather detective trying to piece it together. Now we're using technology, the social media in particular, to get us information, to get us tips, and then we're working backwards and solving cases. And what we're seeing in a lot of our gang cases is on social media, all the evidence is there. They're taking credit for shootings. They're keeping score, one gang versus another. And the benefit is to the public because we're solving cases. And when we solve one of these gang shootings, we prevent the natural and always occurring retaliation. I've called it the peace dividend. We're kind of in the mode right now where we're getting benefit that because there have been less shootings, each shooting we prevent means one less shooting that's going to take place that's retaliatory.
And in terms of who's actually committing the crimes, are you finding that it is some of the same individuals over and over again? A common lament has been that recidivism rates are very high and that really only a handful of people are committing the worst crimes.
Yeah, we hear the police commissioner talking about that all the time. It's true in almost every context. Our burglars tend to be serial burglars, the people committing small petty larcenies at the chain pharmacies are the same people, like, you know, a small percentage are responsible for 40% of the shoplifting. It's particularly true in gun violence. We estimate, and there's a lot of social science data around this, about half of 1% is responsible for anywhere between 50 and 60% of the crime. So what we've done in my office through our crime strategies unit is, who are those people in Brooklyn, and can we keep a watchful eye on them and then build cases even before they commit the next shooting? Let's go back and solve some of the past crimes they've done.
And is a lot of it gang activity?
Yes. I would estimate in terms of the violence, it's 60 to 70% of the violence in the county.
Is there a basis of comparison you can give me? I mean, is there maybe more gang affiliation these days? Maybe people are able to find each other more easily online compared to in the old days, or even, you know, some of the highest crime rates we saw in the late 80s and early 90s?
I think the crime is different because what we saw in the 80s and 90s in particular was a lot of crimes really based on financial motivation. There were robberies and burglaries and the outcome was to get money, take jewelry, and that's what people felt like on the subways, right? If I could be, I could protect myself from being a victim of a crime by being smart about the way I dressed or hiding my jewelry. And even the gangs back then were much more motivated by making profit, selling drugs. Today, the violence seems to be just about geographic dominance and really these beefs that have taken place generationally, and these young men no longer know why they're shooting at the kid they used to play basketball with, but now they're a part of a different gang, and so they shoot at each other. And so the crime motive is not as financial as it used to be, and I think that causes a lot more unease in our communities because we don't know if we're going to be a victim of random violence. We know how to protect ourselves from not wearing flashy jewelry or being in the wrong place late at night, but it seems like so much of the violence today seems random.
And that's what I was going to ask about also, because how do you police that? How do you do law enforcement against gang activity? I get, right? You can identify who the players are who are more likely to engage in violent behavior, but people feel, at least what we used to be told when I was a reporter, that there is a post-pandemic fear of random violence, of getting pushed on a subway track, something like that. How do you persuade people that they're safe or that that's not going to happen to them? And how do you prevent something like that?
Yeah. A bunch of great questions. I mean, what I try to do as DA is, when I speak to constituents and people in Brooklyn, do you feel safe in your home? Do you feel safe on your block? Do you feel safe in your community? And you have to kind of build it out as small blocks. And what I, you know, like say, do you feel safe in New York City is a loaded question, but do you feel safe in your neighborhood? And that's kind of what I try to do as DA is try to, you know, level set where do people feel unsafe and what's their fear based on. And a lot of it is around this random violence that people are on the subways. They see people acting out with mental health issues, issues of homelessness, and feeling like it's not a safe place. Typically, people in Brooklyn say they feel safe in their communities, but less safe when they travel into Manhattan by train. The good news for Brooklynites who are listening to the podcast today is that subway crime is down 30% at the start of this year in Brooklyn. It was down last year and it was down the year before. So we're making progress. In terms of identifying who the problematic people are in the subway, we see a lot of the same things, people who have recidivist kind of nature involved, and we could identify them. Often they have mental health challenges, and there's some work to be done around that. I also think that, you know, we have to start thinking about safety and design. Like, are there things we can do to prevent some of the harm that takes place in our subway? Where do we put cameras? Are there kind of measures we can put with gates preventing people from getting pushed onto the subway platform? It's not that these things are not expensive, but I think that they would help provide a sense of safety and security if people felt visible presence of police officers, not just collecting the tolls up the fare gate, but actually on the subway cars or on the platform. So we want to be smart about how we use our resources and about the way we do the design. There are things we can do, for example, to keep our conductors safe. You know, could we install a little like GoPro camera so they don't have to stick their heads out before they know who's there? There's a lot of simple design things that could be done that will keep people safe. There'll be less incidents, and then because there's less incidents, people will start to feel safer.
And there's a lot of security measures are very much for what you're talking about. In other words, making people feel more at ease in something like a subway system or before they get on an airplane, for example.
Yeah, prevention, right? Like an ounce of prevention means a lot, right? So if we prevent that from happening, the incident won't take place and people will feel safer and will be safer.
I want to ask you about Albany. As we are taping, the state budget has not yet been finalized, but it does appear as though there has been a breakthrough on a controversial issue, which is discovery reform. 2019, as you remember, the lawmakers in Albany changed the rules governing discovery. And I'm wondering if you could just tell me a little bit about what that was and what the problem was that they're now trying to go back and fix.
Yeah, so in 2019, I think there was widespread agreement that prosecutors had a tremendous tactical advantage in the courtrooms, that the law did not require the complete exchange of information with the defense until right before trial. So in many cases, defenders felt that they didn't have an accurate understanding of the allegations that their clients faced, or that the accused didn't feel like they really understood the case against them, and they were often forced into situations either to go to trial or to accept a plea bargain. And what the legislature wanted to fix in 2019 was the sense that, they were disadvantaged. They called it the blindfold law. So they wanted the early exchange of all information in the very beginning of the legal process so that an accused would understand the case against them, any weaknesses, what the strengths are. And that's what they achieved. But the way the law was drafted, it was too rigid, and it led to too many dismissals. The numbers speak for themselves. It's a 4-time increase in dismissals because not only did they want the early exchange of information, but they tied it to speedy trial, which meant that if the DA could not get all the materials, the case was dismissed. The other part that was done was they expanded the information that was required in the first place. So we had to provide more. We had to do it very quickly in the very beginning of the case, and it was tied to our speedy trial time. And so in places like Brooklyn or New York City and Manhattan, where you have 80,000 arrests or 65,000 arrests a year, the thought that you can do everything the law required under the time frame just proved to be too much. The governor's proposal was to make sure that judges would have an individualized opportunity to look at the work of a DA and say, is there good faith? Did they do the job in good faith? Did they exercise due diligence? And whether what's missing, what was provided late, did this create some kind of harm or damage to the defense?
Is it relevant to the case?
Is it relevant? Well, not just relevant, but did it hurt the defendant, the lack of that information? Because some of the dismissals were based on things that were not relevant. I think there's a conceptual agreement in place that there's going to be some changes to the law, but the core of the law remains intact. It has to be in the very beginning of the case. Speedy trial still amounts, and we still have to provide all of this information in good faith and due diligence. But what it does allow a judge to do is, say, the 10th memo book of an officer who's never testifying in the case. That was turned over late. That's not a basis to dismiss the case and allow that case to continue. Victims deserve as much. I keep telling the public that they say, well, the prosecutor needs to be held accountable if they provide it late. But the reality of this is that every case has a victim behind it, and the system was failing victims. The governor's proposal keeps New York State as the most progressive discovery statute in the country and will better serve victims. And I'm grateful to her and to the speaker, in particular, Carl Hastie, because they worked really hard to get to this agreement.
A couple stats from the New York Post. Dismissals of cases went up from 2019, where there were 10,000, up to 50,000 last year. You alluded to this before, just how much those statistics have gone up in an alarming way. 94% of domestic violence cases were getting thrown out. In your mind, does this compromise give you the tools that you need to prevent those stats from either continuing to climb or even staying where they were, which is much higher than they were 6 years ago?
Yeah, I think the compromise is going to show progress. It's a compromise. The prosecutors did not get everything that we asked for.
But nobody ever does in Albany.
But I think sometimes that's, what a fair system look, the elected officials, we're trying to make it fair for both accused and for victims. I think the balance struck in this deal is going to make it better for everyone. And it's going to clarify the law in important ways that, for the media, for the community to understand that, it was not the intent of the law to create dismissals. There are judges who I think believed that they were given no discretion, and so they had to dismiss. I think the new way the law is written, which says the holistic approach to evaluating whether the discovery was done in good faith and in the exercise of due diligence will allow judges to say, yes, something was late, but this is not relevant to the case, and so the case may continue.
So giving them a little bit more discretion.
Yes. I'm a big believer that we can't take the judges out of the equation, and some of the laws over time have given judges less discretion. This is looking to give judges more discretion.
Well, it's really interesting to hear you say that, because one of the big fights, as you remember, in Albany a few years ago was over bail reform. And when they actually passed bail reform, I think conceptually most people would agree it is not right to have people, enforce bail being forced for some and not for others. And people who can afford to get out of jail were getting out of jail. But part of the problem is that in many instances, they wanted to do what other states have done, which is give judges discretion, have kind of a violence standard or a judge make a call on whether or not someone should remain behind bars. And some of the lawmakers felt as though that was not a good idea, that the judges should not have that discretion. Where do you fall on that?
I mean, we elect our judges. There's some judges who are appointed by the governor and by the mayor, but typically Supreme Court judges are elected in New York State. They should have discretion. They're supposed to be sort of the umpire calling balls and strikes in the courtroom, and they need to have the ability to make individualized assessments. So when you strip them of all of their power to make decisions, I think we move in the direction of injustice. If something has to happen a certain way, whether or not that's the right result, that is not my definition of justice. We still give judges, and we have to be consistent with our logic, we still allow judges to make those decisions on the violent cases. It seems to me that on other cases, judges still need to have that ability. So I support giving judges discretion. I think it's fine for the legislature to tell judges what how they would like to see the
criteria
system work.
Yeah.
And so I think that we've reached the right balance right now on bail reform. I don't see us going back and changing bail reform anytime soon. We're going to see how that works, and I hope that we've reached the right balance now on discovery. I'm confident that we've made improvements for sure.
And bail, they had to revisit a couple of times, right? I mean, there were changes that they made, in subsequent years, long after they had passed the original law.
Yeah, and I think that is a good thing. So much of the opposition around discovery reform is that it's a rollback. I think good government, takes a look after a couple of years, 2-3 years, and say, are we getting the desired result? Is this what we wanted years ago? And I think the legislature acting now they made it clear, we don't want to see all those dismissals. We want to see a more balanced system. They went and they made corrective action, and they should be applauded for that, because that's what good government should be. We should not continue to do the same things, whether it works or it doesn't work. Here we looked at it. We saw a four-time increase in dismissals. You had 62 DAs across the state who said, we can't do the law as it's currently constituted. We just don't have the resources. We don't have the capacity to do this. And the legislature listened and did not completely roll back what the goal of this was, which was the early exchange of information. And that's what good government should be. And we should actually be thankful that, you know, the speaker and the majority leader and others listen to the concerns of the governor and the prosecutors.
No, it's a fair point. And I think what a lot of people sometimes don't realize about Albany, you're legislating from Albany for 20 million people. It's tough to get that right, you know, and it's important to get it right. So having a willingness to go back and revisit something and say, okay, the statistics are not where we want them to be, let's take a look at this, is actually exactly how the process is supposed to work.
And the criminal justice context is very interesting, because New York City is so different than the rest of upstate. And so writing a law that works for the people upstate New York and New York City, it requires you to go back and look at the impact of the law. And they did.
And in terms of the reforms that took place, it was really when the Democrats kind of took power in the Senate. As you know, it was divided government for many, many years. You had Republicans in control of the state Senate. Democrats were in control of the Assembly and still are. But when Democrats kind of won both houses, one of the first priorities was to go after criminal justice laws, which they thought were unfairly treating certain communities. And I guess my question to you, did some of those go too far?
Yeah, I mean, this is why we went back and asked for amendments. But I think what belied these decisions were we did see issues of racial disparities in our justice system. We have to acknowledge that the system did treat people differently. People who were poor were being held in a couple hundred bucks for bail. And so how much money someone had in their bank account determined their liberty or not non-liberty. That didn't make sense from a public safety standpoint. Someone who's a career criminal, whether they have a few more dollars in their bank account, you know, they were allowed to be, you know, free, but someone who's poorer has to stay in. That did not jive with me,
right.
And I thought we needed to fix that. And on discovery, not turning over important documents until right before the trial is unfair. Prosecutors also have a role to play in this. When things are not fair in a system, and I ran as a reform-oriented DA, we have to call those things out too. We have to say, this is not fair, because our constituency is not simply victims of crime. It's the entire community. And when things do not run appropriately or fairly in our court system, prosecutors have an obligation to speak out on that. I have, as you know, other DAs in New York City. So but we do have to continuously speak out on things that don't work.
And you were part of this debate in Albany, right? I mean, the most recent one on discovery. I know that district attorneys were, you know, making a big contribution in terms of giving input to the legislators, what was working, what wasn't.
Yeah, I think what we tried to do very carefully as, you know, elected DAs was to take it out of the political context, right? Because there's a lot of like political back and forth about whether it's a rollback, it's not a rollback. And I think what the governor charged us with do is stay out of the politics, let the politics play itself, get into sort of the legal policy, get into the policy arguments that we need to make this work. And so I stayed out of the politics of it, but I used my, you know, 25 years plus experience at looking at these cases to try to help draft a law that would work for both defenders and for prosecutors.
And the legislators were amenable.
They
trusted
were,
your expertise. And,
they were great. They were really great, because, you know, part of it is they had to go back and amend what they did. And sometimes that's hard for people to do. And it's why I give them a lot of credit.
Let me ask you, because I'm less familiar with Brooklyn, but I can tell you, at least in Manhattan, that there's a lot of concern in communities about shoplifting in some of the big stores, and that items are locked up. Is there anything that could be done to remedy that, to make that sort of, when you're going into a store like that, you don't feel under siege?
Yeah, we have to fix it. Very clear data on this. You know, there's a small number of people who get arrested over and over. In my office, we take a look at people who've been arrested more than five times for shoplifting. You know, this is not a one-off, you know, shoplifting because of a crime of poverty if you've been arrested five times.
And more often it's that, you would say.
I would say in terms of the recidivism,
yeah,
it's if you talk to store owners, they see the difference between someone who's stealing a piece of meat or cheese because they're hungry. They probably don't even call the police on those people versus the people who are coming in all the time and, you know, basically, you know, ripping off the establishment because they sell it and this is, you know, how they support themselves. That's a different type of crime. And that's what they mean by sort of organized retail theft. Like those people who go in and steal, you know, 20 tubes of toothpaste, they're selling that to somewhere else. And many New Yorkers are helping to support that by buying it, you know, unlawfully online.
From, secondary market.
Yeah. And you know, if you're buying a Ralph Lauren shirt that sells for $90 at Macy's and you're buying it for $40 online, you're either buying counterfeit or you're buying something stolen.
Right. And I remember it was so bad during the pandemic that at the CVS they would, you know, literally take stuff out of the stores and then throw it on a blanket, you know, a couple blocks down and sell it to people.
Yeah. But we're making a lot of progress on that as well. And the governor and the legislature also passed laws to help that as well. You know, to protect retail workers from assaults. And so we've made a lot of progress. New York City is, in my opinion, starting to come back to what it was pre-pandemic. And in Brooklyn, you know, I can tell you that right now, you know, we're beating where we were in 2018 and 2019 in terms of overall crime. So not just violence, but just the overall sentiment of crime, the index crimes. So I am very optimistic that this can be the safest year in Brooklyn's history. Obviously, the summer is the crucial month for us because 50% of our crime happens between, you know, June and September, right? That's where
people are out on the streets.
That's where the violence and, right, you know, things really tick up. If we can have a safe summer in Brooklyn, we're going to shatter public safety records this year.
This police officer I used to know in New Jersey used to say that rain was the best cop.
Well, April's been pretty good.
Yeah. And let me just ask you real briefly about the pandemic. Was that sort of a turning point? I mean, did that lead to the sort of rise in crime that people are perceiving all these years later? Was that kind of sort of the starting point of that?
Well, in terms of raw numbers, right, the answer is we saw a tremendous spike in almost every category of crime. There were a lot of reasons for that, you know. There was just a lot happening, right? There was, you know, Brooklyn went from about 80,000 arrests to probably about 38,000 arrests during that year, right? So obviously those kind of reduction in enforcement is going to play an issue. Our violence interrupters and our people who are helping to prevent shootings, they didn't have the PPEs, they weren't getting paid, they weren't doing the work that they do, the parole officers weren't doing the home visits. You know, the detectives were out sick or, you know, there was a lot less officers on the streets. Everything kind of collapsed at once and we paid the price for it. I was very confident when there was a lot of calls to be very, very tough on crime again, that if we in Brooklyn just continue to do what we would do, which was focus on the drivers of crime, continue to engage our community partners, and a lot of that is around prevention of crime, like just continue to lean in on the prevention and then prosecute the cases smartly that the numbers would come down. That's what we've seen, and that is going to continue to be the formula, including using the technology that I've been talking about.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. District Attorney Eric Gonzalez from the Borough of Brooklyn, thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to see you again.
You too. The Lobbying Insider is a production of Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron, LLP, New York's premier middle market law firm, practicing in over 20 areas, including commercial litigation, economic development, real estate, and of course, government relations. The Lobbying Insider is produced by Joe Benti, and our sound recording engineer is Devante Addison. Publicity by Jody Fisher PR with Beth Ann Mayer at Lemon Seed Creative managing social media. Our podcast platform manager is Monica Thomas. I'm Zach Fink, host of the podcast, and if you'd like to help us spread the word about our show, please share it with colleagues and friends, and be sure to subscribe on your platform of choice. It can be found on Apple, Audible, Google, iHeart, Podbean, and Spotify platforms. Thanks for joining us.